This is episode 357. Are you in a happy, loving relationship? Or does your partner piss you off sometimes? Tell you things that you care about don't matter? Or totally miss the mark when you need help, love, or support? Maybe you feel alone in your romantic relationship, or you cycle through partners at a really high rate of knots. Or you even feel that doing life on your own is much better because you can't trust anyone with your heart. On today's episode, we talk about attachment theory and how to uncover and work with your core wounds, which we all have, and find your core needs so that you can create romantic and platonic relationships that are loving, nourishing, and fulfilling, whilst also understanding which relationships are toxic or trauma bonded, and whether you decide to end the relationship or get divorced, or do the deep subconscious work on yourself. This episode is gold. Honestly, it's so good. And so, I don't want to get in the way any further. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Here we are hanging out, about to blow your mind, as always, obviously. First thing is that in 2024, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. And the links to apply for my emotional eating, binge eating, and overeating programs are in the show notes below this episode. Now, I'm very much looking forward to sharing this conversation with you because today we've got Thais Gibson here in the virtual podcast studio. Thais has a PhD and 13 certifications in modalities such as CBT, NLP, somatic experiencing, internal family systems, and shadow work. And all of that makes her an expert in attachment theory. And in the process, she has developed her own revised version of attachment theory called Gibson Integrated Attachment Theory. And that is a framework uniting traditional attachment theory, developmental psychological insights, and potent subconscious reprogramming techniques. And if all of that sounded like a load of jargon, don't worry. We're going to get into it today and how it relates to the way you attach to people. Now, she used to run a private practice that was super overrun with clients, 30,000 of them, in fact, followed by a two-year waitlist to actually get in to see her. And so she decided to create an online version called the Personal Development School, which is actually also a podcast as well and has over 38 million views on social media. And in surveys of people in the Personal Development School, they report an 88.7% improvement in their relationships. Now, who doesn't want that? Now, this amazing woman is also an author with her latest book out now called Learning Love. Welcome to the show, Thais. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here with you.
I'm excited to have you here. And you were talking before we hit record about the fact that this is your fourth of five podcasts today. You are a superwoman.
I love talking to people. It's like how I want to spend my time is like having really interesting conversations. So it's like, it doesn't make me feel tired or anything. I really, really enjoy this kind of stuff.
Yeah, amazing. Well, as I said before, kindred spirits, I'm here with you on that. I've got lots of talking to do today and it's the start of the day for me, the end of the day for you. But I think a good place for us to start is maybe with what are attachment styles? What's the classical definition? I know a lot of people in the audience may have read the book called Attached, and that sort of went through a bit of hype in the last few years. So what are the classical attachment styles?
Okay, so there are four major attachment styles, and the original form of attachment theory was developed by John Bowlby out of Cambridge University, later Mary Ainsworth. It's actually something I learned about in first year psych class in university, but they kind of scratch the surface. They don't talk about how we can change our attachment style or, you know, how we have different wounds and fears according to our attachment style. So the four main attachment styles is number one, securely attached. Now, a securely attached child basically experiences a lot of approach-oriented behaviors from their parents in childhood, meaning if they cry or express negative emotion, the parents come towards them and try to soothe them. And it sounds like a small thing, but it has a really big impact. If there is a parent who's consistently approach-oriented towards their child, guess what the child learns? They learn, my needs are worthy of being met. It's safe to express emotion. It's safe to rely on other people. I can trust that other people care about me and I am worthy of love. And so securely attached children grow up to be securely attached adults who are capable of believing in those things in relationships, being vulnerable, feeling like they can trust. They have generally a greater sense of self-esteem, and they are willing and able to be there for others in a similar context because that's how relationships were modeled to them. The three insecure attached styles, unfortunately, got various forms of not so great modeling around relationships. And sometimes it's because of big T trauma experiences, but sometimes it's small T trauma experiences that happen repeatedly over time. So on kind of one end of the continuum, in a sense, we have the anxious attachment style. The anxious attachment style either goes through real abandonment or perceived abandonment. So this can be that we have two really loving parents, but they work all the time. They're constantly traveling for work. And to a young child, that feels like love is there, love is taken away. Love is there, love is taken away. So this child, as an adult, becomes really concerned about abandonment. And they tend to really fear being excluded, disliked, rejected, not good enough, abandoned, alone. These are like the big core fears that they have. And so as adults, they become individuals who constantly want to maintain proximity. They get really afraid of closeness being taken away. And they will often hold on a little too tight to people in relationships and sometimes exhibit needy or clingy behaviors. On the other end of the attachment continuum, we have our dismissive avoidance. Dismissive avoidance, their overarching theme of their childhood is childhood emotional neglect. And when a child gets neglected emotionally in childhood, they are not ones to go, oh, my parents are emotionally unavailable. They instead, like all children, hyper-personalize. So they go, oh, there must be something wrong with me that I can't get these needs met because we are wired for attunement and connection from our caregivers as children. So it feels like this ongoing feeling of rejection. So they suppress the need for emotional connection and intimacy in relationships in favor of adapting to that environment and going, okay, well, if I just don't need anything, then I'll feel fine. So they suppress their need for attachment. And of course, as adults, they tend to fear that something is wrong with them. So they tend to have a lot of internalized shame. They can be more sensitive to criticism than you would ever realize. And they also get afraid of being committed and being trapped or helpless or powerless in the wrong relationship. And they tend to assume their needs won't really get met anyways, and that we should just all kind of take care of ourselves. And so they struggle to really be vulnerable. That's not a strength of theirs. And they constantly keep people at arm's length. So you'll often see a dismissive avoidant constantly be sort of pushing people away. And then very last but not least, there's the fearful avoidant, aka disorganized attachment style. This individual usually goes through a lot of chaos in their childhood. It could be parents with substance abuse issues, going through physical or sexual abuse as children, or a parent with a cluster B personality disorder, like being a narcissist or borderline personality disorder. And it could even be something like just tons of fighting in the household and a really messy divorce. And so this child grows up with conflicting ideas about attachment. On one hand, they believe it's a really beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're like really scared of it because they have some really good experiences with love and connection, but some really horrifying ones. And so they grow up to think, okay, I want love, but I'm really scared of it. I can't trust it. And they're constantly the individuals in relationships who are like, come here, get close to me. And then you get close to them and they're like, get back. And they're very hot and cold in relationships all the time. And they tend to question relationships on a very ongoing basis and struggle to trust. That was my attachment style.
Me too.
Is that you? Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. So you know everything about what it means to be a fearful avoidant.
I do.
Yeah. So those are the four major attachment styles. And our body of work now is about how can we change? How can we become securely attached if we are realizing, hey, you know, this isn't my fault that I'm this attachment style, but I probably don't want to go through all of life like this because there can be some painful patterns on the other end of it for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I was going to ask that question next because I think there's this movement in society at the minute that's sort of suggesting, or it's different sides of, I guess, the political landscape, but there's this side that we've kind of swung to, let's say, in personal development, which is let's explore every part of our being and heal and come out the other side as, you know, beautiful, energetic butterflies. And then on the other side of that pendulum, there's this movement to, sort of in response to that ultra fluffy, safe idea of where we've lost true masculinity and we've lost true strength. And obviously, this is applicable to women, but in the context of traditional strength and willpower and grit and the ability to get through things. And so we've got some people that are sort of judging that and saying, all the kids these days are into this being loved and being cared for, and that fundamentally makes them weaker in some ways. And it's like, you know, back in my day, we just sorted ourselves out. And so all of that to say, my question comes down to why is your work important?
Oh my gosh, I love this question. I love the pretext that you just gave, because I agree with you. There's polarities right now around this stuff. And mm-hmm. I think if I could sum this up in one sentence, I would say your attachment style is not your fault, but it's still your responsibility. And what I mean by that is that we need to honor that it doesn't feel good, right? Like, as a fearful avoidant, you can probably relate, like being hot and cold in relationships and constantly flip-flopping and having a hard time trusting people sometimes. Like, these are hard things, and we need to validate and acknowledge our feelings around that stuff. It can be difficult to go through that, and they usually come from hard experiences. Same thing with being a dismissive avoidant or anxious attachment style. So we want to be able to exercise self-compassion. But we also want to be able to show up for ourselves and be accountable and responsible for our behaviors and have the grit to acknowledge these things and move through them. And I think that we, to your point, like, live in this world where it's always like all or nothing. It's like you're either, oh, just accept everything, be so compassionate that you never acknowledge or be accountable for your behaviors. Or the polar end is like, you're a snowflake and you should just get it together. And it's not either extreme. It's really not. It's like that combination of both. Yes, grit is necessary sometimes. Yes, we have to power through things and we have to have the strength to acknowledge and be accountable. But if we just power through everything, we're creating this context for more dismissive avoidant attachment style. And so what we want to do is have that compassion, that care, that self-love, and also be able to do the work.
I'm curious in regards to doing the work, because correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the initial idea of attachment theory that you cannot change your attachment style? Was that the initial belief?
The initial belief was insinuating that. That was never like what they specifically said. It was like, you have an attachment style. This is how it comes about. And this is basically going to be the temperament that you have in relationships. It was almost like there wasn't this sense of it being fully complete, because they didn't dive deeper into how does that then affect all our adult relationships? What about neuroplasticity, which was not as mainstream of a thing as it is now? What about how we can recondition our patterns and programs? And then how does that apply to our relationships? And that's where we kind of jumped in and created more work around a lot of this.
Yeah. So I guess, where does one begin? Because I know a lot of people end up getting stuck in the self-observation phase, or they can reflect on their life and say, yeah, I've had these problems time and time and time again. I'm the common denominator, and that's just the way it is, you know? So like, how does somebody go from, I guess, awareness of problems to actually being different? And I say this as somebody, like we just sort of both confessed as to our own attachment styles, I say this as somebody who sort of got stuck in that world of trying to read all the books and do all the things and all the meditations and all the inner healings and mushroom ceremonies and everything to try and change that core desire. And the way that it showed up for me was that I knew what a healthy relationship looked like and should be like, but once I'm in one, I don't feel loved in that environment because I'm conditioned to feel love in a toxic environment, right? And so I found that to be really tricky. It's like, I know what's going on, but I still don't want to go towards the right thing.
Yes. Okay. So these are such good questions. Well, so, okay. Your conscious mind is responsible for roughly 3-5% of your beliefs, thoughts, emotions, and actions. The conscious mind is like our logical thinking mind, for anybody who's more unfamiliar with this concept. And that is our sort of rational self. Our subconscious mind and unconscious mind collectively are responsible for 95-97% of our beliefs, thoughts, emotions, and actions. And our subconscious mind works very hard to maintain its comfort zone. Mm-hmm. So what you're speaking of is you have a subconscious comfort zone in chaos. And then your conscious mind says, I should be with somebody more secure. I should be in healthy, loving relationships. Your conscious mind can say all kinds of things. I'm going to stop eating chocolate. I'm going to go to the gym every day. I'm going to, you name it. But at the end of the day, your subconscious mind runs the show. And so what we found, and this is, so I first started actually with a background in hypnotherapy, and I didn't like the power dynamics. I thought it was strange that, hey, you come in and like you have to foster all this dependency on me as, you know, the person who's going to come in and do the work for you, and then you leave and you don't know how to recreate that for yourself. I really didn't like that. And so I got really interested in, well, how do you package this for people so that they can learn to reprogram their own subconscious mind in a conscious state? And so we found that in order to do that work to heal, there's 6 major areas, but really it's, there's sort of like 2 minor and 4 major for a total of 6 areas that we need to target to become securely attached. Number one, reprogramming core wounds. Okay. So these are our like pieces of relationship baggage. The anxious attachments, like I'm going to be abandoned. The dismissive avoidance, like I'm defective. Fearful avoidance, like I'm going to be abandoned and trapped. and I can't trust, right? So we tend to have major core wounds. There's a few more than just those for each attachment style. And these are not things we're born with. They get conditioned into us through repetition and emotion over time. And so we can recondition these things, leveraging the principles of neuroplasticity that we now know exist today. And I can even share a tool for how to do that in a little bit. So core wounds is number one. Number two, we need to learn our needs. Needs in a relationship are like the lifeblood. If we are not feeding a relationship with each other's needs, then the relationship's not being nourished. It's like a plant without water, like it can't survive. And so we need to understand that we have unique needs. And based on our attachment style, we're going to have different needs. So you can see like an anxious attachment style, they tend to need more certainty, reassurance, to feel wanted, to feel like a priority, to be encouraged, validated. And if you look at dismissive avoidance, they need freedom, independence, autonomy. They also need appreciation and acknowledgement in small forms, and they need empathy, support, and acceptance. Fearful avoidance, they really care about having this sense of depth in their relationships. They don't want superficial things. They want depth. They want novelty. They want growth. They want the independence and freedom, but they also want that deep connection and that closeness and certainty. So what happens is we often get into relationships with people of different attachment styles, don't know the needs, try to project from our perception. We think everybody needs what we need. We try to give people what we need. And then it sort of falls on deaf ears, right? So we have to, number one, reprogram core wounds. Number two, we actually need to learn to meet our own needs first. This is a big part of how we become securely attached. Number three, we need to learn to regulate our nervous system. So if we've constantly been in fight or flight, breath work, meditation, these sorts of things, to get back in our body and feel safe and to get into parasympathetic nervous system mode, rest and digest mode, is actually a big part of our attachment healing. Number four, learning to set healthy boundaries, and then learning to communicate with other people will help shift and change our behaviors. So what we found is through tens of thousands of client sessions I did over about 10 to 12 years, where I would see 40 or so people a week, I found that these six areas are the six crucial points that we need to target at a subconscious level. Because you can do all kinds of, to your point, analysis and learning from behind a book, but unless you're actually targeting your subconscious mind, it really doesn't have that big of an impact. So we need to do reprogramming of each of these six major areas, but particularly the first four. And in doing that, in reprogramming core wounds, meeting our own needs, communicating those needs to others, emotionally regulating and setting boundaries, by doing those major things, we actually move the needle to become securely attached. And research shows, a lot of the research we've done is like within a 90-day period, if people are really plugging into the tools, we can see that they become dominantly securely attached as long as they're targeting the subconscious mind in the process.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think that would give a lot of hope to anyone listening, is that it can change. And the data shows that. And I would argue that my own life is an example of being able to change that as well. You know, and so the other thing that I thought of just as you were speaking there was the idea, and I love this quote, which is people trauma needs people to heal. And the reason that I say that is because I think, and maybe I did a little bit too, get stuck in this personal development space personally on my own, right? And doing all the work and doing all the things by myself. And what I've noticed in my world here in Melbourne and Australia is I've gone towards these different personal development communities and spiritual groups and all of these types of sort of wellnessy oriented, you know, people. And the more that I learned over the years, the more that I started to see that this was a group of what I phrase as spiritually arrogant people. And what I mean by that is that the personal development people that seem to have it all together are all alone. And I'm generalizing, obviously, but they're scared of those relationships, or they use this thing that I phrase as spiritual gaslighting to actually say, you know, I don't want to do this or I don't want to do that, when really it's, I'm not good at committing to relationships and I'm terrified of being connected to people. And so I really believe, and I'm not sure if you share this, but in order to do this work, you need to actually be in relationships to fix your attachment style.
I love this. So yes and no. Okay. I agree with you that there can absolutely be a lot of like spiritual bypassing too, right? Mm-hmm. Where people are like, yes, like something bothers them and they kind of invalidate their own feelings. And they're like, oh, it's fine because it's just about God, or, you know, there's some higher, you know, and it reminds me of like a great Eckhart Tolle quote. And he talks about how we are a human being. We have the human part, which means like we are here on the planet as a human being. Like you have that part that's inevitable with needs and human relationships and interactions. And then we have the being part, the spiritual part. And what's really interesting, and what I found through like our body of work of integrated attachment theory, is we've actually orchestrated it that way. So we start with the inner work first, and there's a reason. We start with core wounds, reprogramming self, right? Mm-hmm. Learning to meet my own needs, learning to regulate my nervous system. And the reason we start with these three things first is because we're reconditioning our own subconscious comfort zone. If somebody has a core wound that I am unworthy and I'm not good enough, and somebody comes along and they're like, oh, you're amazing. Guess what that person does? Their subconscious, it feels good at first, but within a moment or two, their subconscious mind, because it's working to maintain its comfort zone, will doubt, deflect, deny, won't trust it, will put that person on such a big pedestal because they're feeding them their needs that they feel like they don't have access to. And that will end up sabotaging relationships. So we are programmed to only really show up for and invest in what our subconscious comfort zone is. So we start with doing the inner work. And I highly recommend we spend at least the first 4 to 6 weeks just doing reprogramming of core wounds and learning to meet our own needs. And if we can add in like a morning or evening meditation or something that's helping to regulate our nervous system, doing that inner work first is really important. But we are interdependent. So that means I have a relationship to myself and I have a relationship to you, to everybody else around me, right? And so if we just do one side of the continuum, it's very problematic. And to your point, if we just stay there, sure, we can, you know, do some healing on our own and feel better in our own company and in our own presence. And that's a great start. But then we're here to have human relationships, to grow with and through people. And we can miss out on the side of relationships. It's like, well, then we have to do the work with somebody else. So of those six parts, core wounds, needs, emotional regulation, self. If you look at the next three parts, boundaries is with people, communication about my needs with people, and then changing my behaviors in terms of how I behave around other people, whether I activate or deactivate, depending on my attachment style. And that makes for like actual interdependent relationships where I'm mastering the relationship to myself and I'm mastering how to do relationships with other people in a healthy, functional way. So we're getting both ends of the continuum.
I'm curious, do you ever see people that are in long-term relationships or marriages that start to fix their attachment style or repair it or change it and then discover that the relationship doesn't work anymore? And I say that from personal experience. I had a 9-year relationship, both of which we were doing work on ourselves and me being the main person that needed a lot of fixing, let's say. And we got to a point where, oh, the trauma bond doesn't exist anymore. And so the relationship doesn't work.
This is such a good question. Yes, it can definitely happen. Because to your point, like it can be a trauma bond for some people. What I say to people, because people can really fear this, is if you start the work and you're doing something, you know, because you're not fulfilled in your relationship, you're still positioning yourself for a win-win. Because if you're doing the work and showing up and healing and growing, you either walk away from the relationship guilt and regret-free because you have the certainty of knowing I did everything I can and now this isn't the right relationship for me. And now you're primed to meet somebody or invest with somebody who is going to be a better fit for you in the future. Or you do the work together and both people show up and grow and heal together. And that in turn allows the relationship to thrive. So sometimes what I'll see, and I'll say this not just from like people in our programs, but in even when I was in client practice back in the day, and it's that we really need both people to be willing to do the work a lot of the time. Because if one person's like in there investing, showing up and doing the work, and the other person's like, yeah, sure, whatever, not really doing more than dipping their toes in the water, then what's going to happen is one person's going to reprogram themselves to become securely attached and the other person's not. And because our subconscious mind wants its comfort zone, we will invest in what is mirrored back to us, right? So we will, secure people are generally attracted to other secure people. Anxious attachment styles, because they are in a dismissive, avoidant relationship to self, right? They're dismissing and avoiding their feelings and needs and boundaries in favor of people pleasing everybody. They're often more attracted to more avoidant leaning individuals. Dismissive avoidance, very preoccupied with their time to self, generally attracted to anxious, preoccupied individuals. So we tend to be most attracted to what's most familiar to us, which is our subconscious comfort zone and how we actually have a relationship to ourselves.
Are we all a little bit of one and a little bit of another? Or do you get to a place where you're basically Gandhi and you're totally secure?
We can definitely get to a place where we're operating very secure. Yeah. I wouldn't say like, you know, being secure doesn't mean you became a robot. Like it doesn't mean if your needs are unmet, you're unbothered, or it doesn't mean that like you'll never get upset by something that's frustrating. It just means that like your ability to handle it and get over it really diminishes, and the frequency and intensity that you're triggered at goes way down, like way less intensive triggering and way less frequently triggered. And when we look at it too, like I actually don't think we're all a little bit of each one. I think what happens is, yes, there's fearful avoidance who definitely relate to the anxious and avoidant side of the continuum. But what you're really looking for is the determining differences are a lot to do with activating versus deactivating behaviors. So anxious attachment styles, even when they're upset or hurt by somebody, they'll generally activate. They might get in a fight, but they'll try to get close to somebody very soon thereafter. Anxious attachment styles, they can feel anxious sometimes. They can feel like, oh, I like this person and I reached out to them. Are they going to go out on the date with me after I ask? Like, you're not a robot. You'll still feel emotion, but they are quick to deactivate away from things that make them feel vulnerable. So they'll be like, oh, I shouldn't really care so much. And they'll deactivate in their behaviors. Whereas fearful avoidance, they will both activate and deactivate very consistently. So that's really how we can determine the difference in our attachment style.
So picture this, right? Unlocking your potential, conquering emotional eating, and gaining insights directly from a health and nutrition expert such as myself. That's what we do inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group, which is currently free to join. If you've ever felt trapped by food challenges, struggled with maintaining a healthy lifestyle, or yearned for a community that understands the reasons why you've yo-yo dieted for years, then there's a new chapter waiting to be written. And this is your chance to start writing it by joining us all on Facebook Lives, on engaging posts that push you out of your comfort zone and into growth, and Q&A sessions with me. All of this works as a platform to begin changing your emotional eating problems for good. Oh, and also, as a special gift, you receive my transformative How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook. And that's also for free. I get it. Skepticism might linger. You might think, Maddie, I've heard these ads and I'm not sure. Well, at least a quarter of the members inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group have been paying clients of my emotional eating program at some point over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you're not sure, you can post in the group and ask to find out if I'm the real deal or not. It's totally up to you. To join us in the free Healthy Mums Collective and to end your emotional eating and feel good in your own skin and begin that journey, pop down to the show notes below, click the link and breeze through 3 simple entry questions. Join today and let's embark on a journey of growth and empowerment. The link is in the show notes below. I'm curious to ask as well, because you've touched on it a little bit a few times now, but those core wounds, I'm wondering if we could sort of go through the sort of main core wounds so people can sort of reflect on their life or their childhood and think, oh, that was me, right? What are they?
Yes, this is one of my favorite topics because this is one of the biggest places to start healing. So the anxious attachment, their big core wounds are, I will be abandoned, alone, unsafe if somebody pulls away from me. Or if I lose somebody, I'll be excluded, disliked, rejected, not good enough, unloved. Okay. So those are like the 8 major core wounds that they have. And when we look at core wounds, they're usually things that we felt at different experiences in childhood, but now are the things that hurt us the most as adults because they're pre-existing core wounds and thus they are triggers for us. Dismissive avoidance, they tend to feel I am defective or something's wrong with me, which is what we tend to feel after childhood emotional neglect. I am unsafe. They actually share. All 3 insecure attachment styles have that, but it's usually vulnerability that makes them unsafe. I am weak if I'm vulnerable. I am stupid is a big core wound that they have. I don't particularly love that word, but It's a big core wound that they have. They don't like to feel stupid. I am disrespected is a big one. And I am trapped, helpless, and powerless. Okay. So they tend to fear being trapped with the wrong person or helpless to figure out how to fix a relationship or resolve things. Fearful avoidance tend to share in both sides of the core wounds, okay? But generally, fearful avoidance feel the most, I will be abandoned, I am unloved can be a big one. Then from the more avoidant side, trapped, helpless, powerless are very big triggers for fearful avoidance. Like feeling trapped is not a nice thing. Mm-hmm. And their extra core wounds that they have tend to be, I cannot trust or I will be betrayed. I am unworthy. They spend a lot of time trying to earn their worth. And I am bad, tend to spend a lot of time proving that they're innocent and that they're kind or that they're not, you know, meaning anything. They can overexplain themselves a lot. So those are the major core wounds for each of the attachment styles. And it's a really important place to start reprogramming.
Oh my God. I so have the, I am bad. I spent so much of my childhood grounded.
Right? I feel like it's the rebelliousness of the fearful one. I got in trouble so much from like 14 years old to 20, 21. I was a troublemaker.
Yeah, I was so in conflict with that part of myself. And maybe I still am now of like being good and the approval that comes from being good. And then also the rebellion of seeking what I would, you know, characterize as the truth that needs to be pursued or spoken or said, you know.
Totally relate to that. I feel like that comes from having that anxious side, like wanting to people please and be connected. And then having the side, it's like, no, I need my individuation, my autonomy, and I need to like pursue what feels true for me.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think as time goes on, I get better at navigating that. The other thing, I don't know if this is a right way to do things, but one thing that I've learned in regards to, you know, you use that word before, chaos. And I think about, you know, my teen years and my 20s and relationships and attachment. I created chaos at all possible opportunity because the way that I learned to love, and it was in chaos, right? And so what I find now is that I have pretty healthy, stable relationships. I'm very good at communicating the, let's say, unhelpful parts of myself. But I notice that I need access to chaos in an organized fashion. And what that looks like for me, it might be playing football. It might be racing go-karts, which I did last night. But I need access to this high intensity, high risk, not at great amounts, but like just on a regular basis. So there's a place that the chaos can exist and I can like get in touch with it again.
Is it chaos or is it novelty and exploration and growth?
That's a good question. I mean, that's always been a part of my personality, even, you know, during the chaos. I was always interested in everything and exploring things all of the time. So that, I would say that that's always been there.
The way I tend to think of it, because I totally understand what you're saying, like I was a chaotic person for sure. Grew up in chaos, knew the chaos, recreated the chaos. But the way I think of chaos is almost more like self-sabotaging, you know, like push people away, react to things. I think of chaos as honestly being born from like our 4F responses when we're in sympathetic nervous system, fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Like we have an overactive fight response. We say things we don't mean and later we're like, oh my God, why did I say that? I just created all this unnecessary chaos. Or we flee the scene too early. Like I, even in my teenage years, when I was first like starting to work, if I was like unhappy with the job, I would just leave. And then you like start again and start again and have to find a job. And to me, like that's a flight response. And so that created chaos. Or freeze. It's like avoid your bills. Don't look at them until, oh no, now I have chaos. Or fun, people please, until I feel frustrated and regretted things I regret and I created chaos. But I think that what happens when we become secure, and this is from my own experience as well, but you know, those needs don't go away. Like I've always needed novelty and exploration and growth. And those have always been really important things. But now I don't go about those things in a chaotic way. Now I get those needs met in a more controlled kind of way where I also value security and not self-sabotaging things. And so I'm curious for you if you think it's actual chaos or if you think it's actually more that those parts of your personality are still there where you still have those needs, but you have a different relationship to them at this point.
Yeah, well, actually, I think that the way that you just described that makes sense. And it's just reframed it in my mind because if I think that novelty and exploration has always been a part of who I am, it's the reason the podcast works. I'm so curious, right? It's the reason that people, you know, gravitate towards me for this stuff because I'm the person that, you know, it's like the idea of if you want something done, give it to a busy person. If you don't know the answer, ask Matty because he'll find out and he'll want to know, you know? Yeah. And so actually maybe the chaos is no longer a part of me at all because it is just that overarching thing that's been there the whole time of curiosity, exploration, novelty. So maybe it is that.
Yeah. But that's what it sounds like to me, right? But you get to sort of see for yourself. But that's what I find a lot. And sometimes I think because in chaos, we also get growth, often the hard way. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of exploration. We have to deal with a lot of different new things. There's a sense of novelty in chaos. So I think that because certain needs are met sometimes more in unhealthy ways through the typical chaos, that we conflate those two things. Mm-hmm. And it could be useful to be like, wait, I'm actually getting these needs met, but in a less chaotic way than what I'm used to.
Yeah, this is great. I feel like I've had healing in this conversation.
Just an interesting conversation.
Totally. I know that a lot of people can get really intimidated by the idea of doing work in the subconscious space. And the reason I say that is because a lot of people, again, logically understand what's going on. And then they hear that the door that they need to walk through is to the unconscious mind, which they have no control over, loosely speaking, you know. Obviously, there's ways to get in there. But the idea of, oh, the door to walk through is meditation, hypnosis, you know, all of these kind of things. And then most people say, I can't meditate. You know, and it's just so overwhelming that it's like, I'm in the dark, there's no lights, and I've got a key in my hand. And apparently there's a door somewhere here to the answer to where I need to go. So how do we actually get into this, you know, subconscious, unconscious, that's so mystical and elusive, and arguably the tools to get through the door are a bit confronting from people?
I love this question. So these are great questions. I'm really enjoying this discussion. So I'll share a simple tool just to give people an idea of how we can reprogram the subconscious mind. So I think it's first important to lay the groundwork that says you know, if you've ever been in a position where you're telling yourself over and over again, you're going to do something like, I'm going to do this for my New Year's resolution. I'm going to make more money. I'm going to stop being angry at people. I'm going to quit eating chocolate. I'm going to exercise every day. And you find yourself just repeating the same behaviors. There's no actual such thing as self-sabotage, right? Like people are like, oh, self-sabotage. Nobody wakes up and they're like, I'm going to sabotage myself today. What we experience as self-sabotage is the conscious mind intending one thing and the subconscious set of belief patterns and needs intending something different. So your conscious goes against your subconscious and we experience that as self-sabotage, right? Conscious mind says, I'm going to go to the gym and eat healthier. And subconscious says, well, we have these other priorities over here. We actually prefer comfort and security. And so we're not really interested in doing that. And so then we're like, oh, I'm sabotaging. But it's not really working like that. So when we look at, you know, how to reprogram our subconscious, it's not really like these big hypnosis types of things. It's more learning how our subconscious mind works. So one of the introductory tools I often give to people is called auto-suggestion for belief reprogramming. So when we talk about core wounds earlier, if anybody heard their core wounds in this discussion and they're like, oh my gosh, I really relate to these core wounds, there's a three-step exercise we can go through. And I'll have to explain the context of it a little bit. So it hopefully will also illuminate that the subconscious isn't really this crazy, scary thing. It's just something that's probably not talked about enough. So conscious mind speaks language. If I say to you, Maddie, whatever you do, do not think of the pink elephant. You know,
too late.
Couldn't help it, right? So conscious mind hears do not. Subconscious mind speaks in emotion and imagery. Okay. So when we try to do things like affirmations, I personally believe those things to be quite futile. Like, because you're saying, let's say you have a core wound, I'm not good enough. And you're like, I am good enough. I am good enough. You're just using your conscious mind to speak to your conscious mind. These core wounds, these limiting beliefs we carry around, they're not, nobody's choosing those things. Nobody's like, I'm going to tell myself today I'm not good enough 74 times and I'm going to see how I feel. Like, these are not conscious choices, they're pre-existing subconscious belief patterns. So we have to speak to the subconscious so that we can actually work through them. So step one, we find our core wound, okay, or whatever limiting belief we're working on. Let's say for argument's sake, I'm not good enough. Okay, what's the opposite? I am good enough. Okay, great. Well, now I have to speak to my subconscious mind. So we know that the subconscious speaks in emotion and in imagery. So what is the container of all emotions and images? It's memory. So if I were to say, Maddie, tell me your favorite childhood memory, you would be like, oh, it was when I was playing on the playground with my friend. And you would see the images of the slide in the playground. And as you tell the story, you would start smiling or laughing, right? You would actually light up and you'd see your emotions change. So all we have to do is leverage that. We have to say, okay, what's the core wound and its opposite? Step one, not good enough. I am good enough. I'm going to be betrayed. I can trust. I'm going to be abandoned. I'm worthy of connection, right? So just oppose the core wound, step one. Step two, we need repetition because repetition is what fires and wires those neural pathways so they strengthen. Mm. And so we come up with 10 pieces of memory for how we felt good enough. And what this does is we get the repetition, the emotion, the imagery to speak to the subconscious, the repetition to fire and wire. So now we're creating these new neural networks. And research shows from a neuroplastic point of view that we need 21 days to really solidify these neural pathways. So we take our 10 memories of when we felt good enough or we felt connected or whatever core wound we're opposing, we record it into our phone perhaps, and we listen back to it ideally in the first hour of the day or last hour before we go to bed because we're producing more alpha brainwaves at that time, which means we're more suggestible. So all we're really doing is we're like 10 memories to oppose my core wound, to listen back to it for 21 days. And we're totally rewiring these neural networks so we can shed these sometimes like really big pieces of relationship baggage we've been carrying around. Because core wounds, they can really disrupt your life. So by doing that, we see we can shed these core wounds and we leave the past where it belongs, which is in the past.
I'm curious. I don't know if I missed it, but are we manufacturing a memory or are we finding a legitimate memory?
Oh my gosh, definitely finding a legitimate memory.
Yeah, okay.
I don't believe in manufacturing memories, that's for sure.
Well, I ask that because what if people don't have any? And I find myself when I'm doing this kind of reflective work, I am struggling to distinguish the truth or a real memory from the manufacturing of a memory in my mind.
Yes.
And I'm like, did that happen? I don't know if that happened. Like, am I just thinking positively about the past or am I reflecting on something that really happened?
Okay, it's a great question. So if people have, like, let's say we use the core wound, I'm not good enough, just to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. Okay, times I actually felt good enough. Okay. If somebody's like, I don't know if I've ever felt good enough, Okay, we can start with things that are very small. We're trying to leverage repetition and emotion. You have this mechanism in your brain called the reticular activating system, which basically will take in information and bring it to your conscious mind's awareness the more you're focusing on something. So if you've ever, like, the really typical example when people talk about the RAS is reticular activating system, is like if you've decided, oh, I'm going to buy a new car, I'm going to buy a white Jeep, and then suddenly you, like, notice the white Jeep on the road all the time. So sometimes when we're struggling for reprogramming, we can kind of leverage how that works. It's like the filtering system of our brain. So we can do what I call first is just start general and then get specific. So we can start with very small pieces of how we felt good enough. I got out of bed on my first alarm this morning. I, you know, said something nice to my coworker at work. I stayed late after work today, or I was there for a friend, right? Things that we feel like, okay, these are signs that I'm good enough. And then we're still leveraging that repetition, that emotion, that imagery. And generally what you'll see is as we get more specific over time, we can come up with these small pieces of evidence, and we can even start by being like, it's possible for me to improve. And when we come up with those small pieces of proof for why, oh, got out of bed in my first alarm, had a nice conversation, we can then move towards, it's possible that I am good enough. And then we can move towards, I am good enough. And so generally we can start like the first 7 days with, it's possible for me to improve. Next 7 days, possible to be good enough. Last 7 days, I am good enough. Mm-hmm. And we're still leveraging the repetition, emotion, and imagery that time. And it doesn't matter how big or small the pieces of evidence are. It matters that we're leveraging them repeatedly, and that will make the process easier and easier. And then the RAS will get on board and start being like, oh yeah, I was good enough last week. I forgot about this thing I did. Oh, I was good enough at this time. And it's funny because usually after the first 7 days or so, people are like pulling things out about themselves that they didn't seem to have access to just a week before, because they're putting their focus and attention in that area.
Do you find benefit? And I think because you've done internal family systems stuff, right? So I'm a big fan of parts work. And I feel like the idea of breaking our memories up into these parts really useful. And I even talk like that in difficult conversations I have now with friends and loved ones and partners, is, you know, talking in parts. And I find it, and I actually had this conversation in my client community just recently about, you know, breaking it all up into parts, or ourselves up into parts. And rather than embodying the whole negative experience, it's like, oh, there's a part of me that feels not worthy, unlovable, terrible, but there are other parts. And I feel like the memory thing kind of latches onto those parts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually really agree with that. I've never thought about it that way, but I really agree with that. It's super interesting how the memory helps you get in touch and sort of regain connection to other parts that might've been out of our awareness at the time. For sure. I agree. I think that's super interesting. And I think too, like, you know, when we look at even like parts work, it can be so useful to see aspects of self, but also because we're getting specific. Like, I think one of the big things that happens is when we look at healing, sometimes people are like, I don't feel good. And it's like, okay, what do you feel? Oh, I feel unworthy. Okay, I'm not unworthy as a whole. I'm feeling a part of me is feeling unworthy. And there's those aspects of self kind of are those fractured parts of self that can happen from trauma, right? In a sense. And so when we can actually challenge and question and let go of our attachment to those beliefs, I find that to also be an integrator from a parts perspective.
Yeah, I like it too. And what came to mind then too is that emotional literacy is, you know, often people start at a place, yeah, I don't feel good, you know, and it's like, well, what does that mean? And I'm not sure, and maybe you can tell me, I don't know if it's like a language thing or a self-literacy thing or an emotional literacy thing, or are there blockages? Like, do people have blocks to actually going down and saying, oh, the actual emotion is unworthiness or unlovableness or disappointed, not angry, right? You know, and it's like this language that needs to exist. Because a lot of people, I guess, think in those terms of just like, I feel awful, I feel happy. And there's sort of only three or four words on either side of that spectrum, when in fact, it's a really long spectrum of all of the different words, which encompass very different feelings and categories. So do people have blockages to actually going in and connecting with those thoughts? Or is it just they need to learn the vocabulary?
So it's a really great question. I find that generally, yes, we start off as a block because we like, how do we know how to access some of these things if we've never been taught? We've never had access to these types of conversations or to this type of material. What I always try to do is like when it comes to core wounds, emotions, and needs, what we do at least in our programs is we put out the core wounds list. So people can look at the core wounds and they can be like, okay, when I feel frustrated over here, what's the core wound? Oh, I tend to get frustrated when I feel trapped. And they can really tend to acknowledge once it's in front of them, okay, here's my emotion and here's the core wound that tends to go with it when it's laid out in front of you. I think it's really hard to do it when it's just from like you trying to pull it up and find the words to express it. And then same thing, like we have like the needs and you go through the needs sheet and it's like, okay, I know I need something from my partner. Oh, it's this. I really need acknowledgement or I really need support. And so I find like once it's there in front of people, they tend to be quite good with it. And even emotions, like we have an emotions list. Okay, am I feeling bad? Well, what's the emotion? Oh, I guess it's frustrated. So I find that just having that in front of people, people know once it's there. And sometimes we have to explore. Sometimes people are like, I can't tell if I feel trapped or powerless, right? And then we can give context for things. But I think that once it's there, people tend to do it. I just think that we don't have a world that historically has been having these conversations enough. And so a lot of people tend to be really new to it. And I just want to say one last thing that's really interesting. On parts work. So there's different types of parts work, right? There's different like schools of thought on it. But something that I found quite consistently is when we're looking at some of the parts work, each part seems to have a core wound and an unmet need. And when we work through the core wound of that part, we work through the unmet need of that part, it tends to actually integrate it back into the whole.
That makes so much sense. I was also going to say for anybody listening, and I'm not sure if you use this app, but there's an app and it's free. It's called How We Feel. And it's an app that I get every single one of my clients to download. And it is so good at teaching you your emotional literacy and feelings. And you spend 30 seconds, maybe two times a day, where it pops up and says, how do you feel? And you go through this quick exercise and it gives you this whole sort of multicolored sort of spectrum of options that you can choose from. And it's got a quick sort of 5 or 6 word definition for each emotion. And it's just, it's so good. So I really recommend that.
I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah. I think we could talk and talk/have therapy sessions for a really long time. but where can everybody find you online? How can they get into your world?
So I am at personaldevelopmentschool.com. We have like free trials going on for our programs all the time. If anybody wants to check anything out and take a look. And then I put daily content out on YouTube at personaldevelopmentschool-Thais Gibson. And then I'm on Instagram as well. We're not as active there, but it's at personaldevelopment_school.
I will put all of those links in the show notes below. So please, obviously Thais is fantastic. So please go down there, click the links and get involved in her world. And before we finish, last question, which is what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
Okay, so I would say, I know this is so, you know, maybe a cop out, but I would say it's really learning about their subconscious mind. I'll tell like a really brief story here. So I had this client. So the biggest things that really affect us at a subconscious level are our core wounds and our unmet needs. And really, we're making decisions all day long based on the interaction between these two things. And just as like a really simple example, back in the day when I was in client practice, I worked with this woman. She had just finished her PhD in like something to do with education. And she was like, hey, I'm supposed to be applying for jobs as a professor. I've been out of school for like almost 8 months and I have done nothing. And what is wrong with me? Mm-hmm. I have no motivation. And what we looked at, which was so interesting, is she had these big core wounds around feeling that she would be rejected and disliked specifically. Mm-hmm. And we looked at her needs, and her needs were emotional connection, social connection, comfort, and safety. Mm-hmm. So her conscious mind says, I'm going to go apply for jobs. Her subconscious mind says, no, we are starving for emotional and social connection. But she was blocking herself because she believed that she would be disliked and rejected if she tried to make new friends. So now your conscious mind doesn't have bandwidth to go over here and do a job because it's hungering for its biggest needs over here. And so what we got her to do is reprogram those limiting beliefs and then actually meet her needs more directly, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, she had this bandwidth open up for like, oh, okay, I can go apply for new jobs. I can go do these things because she started to meet her needs for social and emotional connection. And now there's room to take part in these other habits. And I would see this in people's New Year's resolutions around health, food, exercise, eating, all kinds of things. And I think like not just from a mental health standpoint, but a physical health standpoint, sometimes we don't change our habits because they're meeting needs for us. When we first are breastfed as children, our first associations to food are comfort, safety, emotional connection, because we produce a lot of oxytocin during that process, which is the bonding neurochemical. So sometimes people are like latching on to unhealthy things because they represent deeply unmet needs that we don't have. And when we start understanding that programming and patterning, and we're like, oh, I can go and get my needs met in healthier ways, so I'm not relying on chocolate bars or cookies or whatever it is to meet these needs, we can actually transform our habits in a physical health way as well.
So I'm going to be a rebel right now. Break the usual structure. I've got another question. How do you figure out what your needs are?
Okay, so this is a big question. So
of course.
It's a great question, though. So basically, there are major overarching themes with our needs, but you know, there are things like emotional connection, social connection, comfort, safety, achievement, personal growth, spiritual growth. I mean, there's roughly 40 major needs. I'm not going to go through and recite all the major needs, but you can see, it's actually really interesting. You can see what your needs are and what you're grasping at by all of your behaviors. So every single thing your subconscious mind does every day, all day long, every behavior we take part in is actually a subconscious strategy to get our needs met through the filter of our belief system, right? So just like that lady, like she was trying to get her social and emotional connection needs met. She was starving for these things. So she spent all day like watching TV reruns of like Friends and the show called Mistresses and reading Twilight novels. She was like trying to get these needs met because she was believed she would be disliked and rejected over here. She would just sabotage doing real life human things and resort to these things over here. So what happens is if we look at a few key areas of our lives, we'll see that everything we do is an attempt to get our needs met. So how we spend our money, how we spend our time, what we tend to love to talk about with people, what we'll naturally read and learn and research about, all of these areas are indicators of what our deep needs are. So if we're researching about health, we might value health. That might be a big need. If we are constantly trying to achieve so that we can get validation, that could be a big need, right? So, or approval, if we're spending our money on fancy things to fit in, we could be, you know, approval seeking or materialistic. So we have all these different needs, but they're actually going to be mirrored back to us in our behaviors. And if you're in a relationship with somebody and you're like, I don't know what my needs are. And we have like needs, we can even put like a needs worksheet if you want. We'll send you a needs worksheet to put in the
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, just for people who can actually look at it because it helps to actually see it. Mm-hmm. But you can see too, like if you ask yourself, in a perfect world, what would I want my partner or friend to do for me all day, every day? Like mm-hmm. how would they show up? And usually whatever it is, oh, they would call me all the time. They would really be supportive. They would really reinforce me or validate me. They would have deep conversations with me. Like whatever it is that we're projecting onto the hope of receiving from somebody else also is a direct reflection of exactly what we're needing.
This has been an incredible episode. Thank you so much for hanging out, having this conversation. And I think you're awesome. And I would love to have you back.
Thank you. I think you're awesome. I'd love to come back and hang out with you.
Amazing. Well, thanks for being on the show. And I guess we'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.